netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hello, and welcome to the FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. The podcast today covers the recently released Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Our guests are director Wes Ball, a longtime friend of FX Guide and FX PhD, as well as Weta Visual Effects supervisor Eric Winquist. Now, this is the point I usually highlight a few interesting things covered in the podcast, but, well, I haven't listened to the podcast because there hasn't been a non-dubbed version here in Mexico until this coming weekend, and I didn't want any spoilers, so, well, that's the way it is. I do want to mention, however, that over at FX PhD, we've made Wes's Secrets of Paint and Roto course that he did for FX PhD way back in 2009 available for free. Check out the FX podcast article at FX Guide for a link, or just head on over to fxphd.com and you'll see it on the homepage. So let's go ahead and cross the interview now as Mike talks to the guys.
So thank you so much, both of you, for doing this. I really appreciate it. For people that are listening to this podcast, we've actually had a bit of trouble organizing it, not least of which I got stranded in Dubai at one stage. It was just like, it's been a mess. But I really appreciate everybody's patience in connecting. The advantage, though, of doing the interview now, though, is when we were going to do it in the past, is I can congratulate you on the film being such a success. As I checked this morning, I think it's like the fourth biggest grossing film worldwide this year already, and it hasn't finished its run. So congratulations.
Yeah, we're 10 days in. You know, who knows what's going to happen? But, it's all glad people are liking it. We'll say that.
Absolutely. Hey, before we get into the visual effects in particular, can I just hit a couple of bigger points that like kind of an elephant in the room? What's this I hear about you wanting to release a version of the film without any visual effects? What's the deal?
So it'll be awesome. I think it'll be a great feature. We've already done it. We've finished it. You're just going to be able to sit there and watch the movie cut for cut, you know. It'll be kind of in a split screen kind of thing where like the final image is on the top and the non-VFX on the bottom, which in our 2:40 aspect ratio works pretty well. And yeah, it's great because, you know, we're used to all seeing the kind of, the usual kind of breakdowns for a sequence or something, you know, and we kind of control when you cut back and forth and what's real, what's not real. This way you just watch it in your eye because they're top and bottom. Your eye is very short travel to kind of cut yourself when you want to see what is real and what isn't, or what is different. It's kind of one of those games where you kind of spot the difference kind of things. And then, you know, obviously for all the full CG stuff, which is about 35 minutes of it or so, you'll be able to see all the mocap stuff on stage, and it's pretty wild. I love watching it that way. It won't be for everyone, but for geeks like us, I think we'll love it.
It's the sort of thing that has been talked about over the last several films of like, oh, it'd be so amazing if people could see a version of the movie with just, you know, Andy in his gray suit and all the rest of our cast. But, you know, we're actually doing it now. It's I don't know. Like when Wes had mentioned wanting to do this, I was like, oh, please do. Like 20-year-old me would have been just so stoked to watch something like this. So I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
It's the Criterion DVD kind of goal. Yeah.
Yeah.
But actually, honestly, I actually don't know where it'll show up, whether it's on what disc or on streaming. I have no idea yet. I'm sure Disney will announce it. But I will say also this, though. We just did the grade for the UHD version of the movie. And man, I got to say, like, I've always I've struggled with the UHD version of things because I don't want to see that far into things, whatever it is. You know, it's like we exposed it for a reason or whatever it is. But it looks freaking amazing. Like, it's actually my favorite version now. Actually, it's kind of perfect. Dave Cole, our other Australian on this movie, who color graded the movie, he found that right recipe that feels like it is the movie, but it just is. Eric, you guys did a great job with all the skies and the fire and all the kind of comp work because it all holds up. It all still sticks. And so anyway, I'm babbling here, but I'm really excited about the post special features kind of stuff.
So Wes, you and I haven't actually chatted about that part of it. I guess with the high dynamic range grade is for a future version, like a future film, let's say, do you think you'd be actually monitoring on set in HDR?
It's interesting. I would if it was going to end up in theaters that way.
Mm, yeah.
You know what I mean? Because that's ultimately, like, I just want to know what we're going to be seeing in that stage. But I was surprised because I've struggled in the past with the HDR version of things, but I was surprised how good it looks. It looked really cool. I was really surprised.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that. But getting back to that split version, what I really like about that concept is there seems to be a couple of perceptions that you have to either be team VFX or team live action. And I don't see there's anything wrong with celebrating both, right? I think there's nothing wrong with celebrating how great the actor's contribution is. And there's nothing wrong with celebrating the fact that the animators produced an enormous amount on top. Like,
and this sometimes film, invented, by the way. It is a team effort because people don't realize that sometimes, Eric, you know, you guys, like, the angle isn't right, or the little blink that we didn't was fine on a human character on an ape suddenly feels like distracting, and they've got to kind of massage it, and there's a lot of interpretation, creative interpretation going on with all these things. But even like you said, this kind of feature, it lets you see what we built. We actually built quite a lot in this movie, even though a lot of it has to get replaced or added to.
Augmented.
We did a lot of stuff to this movie from all the different departments, and I think this little top and bottom, like raw version, I guess, of the movie, it celebrates all departments of what it goes into making a movie, which I think is fun.
Well, I mean, Mike, you point to the practical versus digital kind of aspect of it. The special effects side, you know, with Rodney and Will, our special effects supervisors on this. The thing that's great about this too is you really can kind of see how much was there that was real that we either blended our stuff with, or, you know, we kept little bits and pieces of it. Like in the river, there's like little sections of it where the water was around, you know, say Freya and in the water and Peter in the water, you know, where you can really see like where the choices were made to keep what was there and where the choices were made to augment it and where the choices were made to completely replace it because we needed to for some reason. And so, yeah, I think it's just going to be great for everybody to see the process. Yeah.
For those people that grew up on DVDs like I did, you know, it's like we used to watch these DVDs and it was like our little film schools. You know, I miss that film school on a disc. You know what I mean? So, you know, it's gotten away from us since streaming happened, but you know, we'll try to do our part.
Yeah, not on this film, but on certain other films, you'd be led to believe from the publicity of like, hey, it was all done in camera, that there's some kind of animosity between the special effects team and the visual effects team. And like, I know that not to be true, but maybe you could speak to that because it really, there's just no, this idea that, you know, somehow the audience doesn't like CG is being completely disproven by this film. I mean, clearly these are not live action apes and the audience loves them.
Yeah, that is, it's just what it is. These things are cycles, right? It's just, especially online, it's a toxic soup we all swim in. We all kind of go in there sometimes. And, you know, you find something to beat up on, you know, because something in their own lives, they get to, you know, be unhappy online, you know, anonymously. So it's just whatever, it's fun.
Well, I can tell you Wes is making a lot of friends in the visual effects community right now. So,
So let's talk about a sequence and that split between what you can film and what you can't. When we talk about the home that gets burnt down at the beginning of the film after the raid, right? You've got a lot of sequences there that have fire. You have a lot of sequences that are obviously shot on location as well, especially prior to the burning sequence. What was the breakdown of like just in that, but just focusing on that for a second, on what you could do in
that's
camera,
a good one.
What you were choosing to do digitally?
That's a good one to talk about, actually, because there's so many different things going on there. Eric, why do you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, the village burning scene, obviously, it culminates in the one or I think it's like 90 seconds, or maybe it's a slightly shorter now, but originally it was like certainly 90 seconds long, single take that we had spent. You know, that was originally came from Jula, our DP, who prevised that himself in Unreal over like a weekend or something. That sort of was worked through with Glenn and our stunt team, and they would just rehearse that and rehearse it and rehearse it and kind of get all the beats down. Because when we actually got out to the location, we'd sort of have to spend our afternoons rehearsing the move, and rehearsing it again, and rehearsing it again, so everybody knew where to be.
Remember, because we knew shot in that 15-minute window of dusk.
Yeah, because we needed to harness like just the perfect time of day where we only had that like say 15-minute window right at like at dusk, and that needed to be the clean plate, and so the Ryan, our Steadicam operator, wasn't going to have anybody to frame on, so he would just have to have that muscle memory built up. So by the time we finally did our take on that, I think we tried it over two nights just to make sure we had down pat. The bits and pieces were all there. The light was just right. The sky looked exactly how we wanted it to. And then we had our special effects team providing us with gas flames, flame bars, and stuff on the ground in the various structures, as well as like a big flare up moment for when, you know, in somewhere like three quarters of the way through that shot, a big nest falls down from the tower and just smashes into all this, this beautiful embers and swirling flame and smoke. They gave us kind of the basis for that with a propane big blast that came up, which provided us light on the location. And it also gave us something to tie our work into in terms of exposure, the textural quality of the fire, all the kind of stuff we'd expect to see. And then that gave all, you know, our side of it at Weta, that gave us the perfect, the baseline, the foundation for the things that we needed to do that couldn't have been done practically due to safety or logistics reasons. And so it was a really beautiful sort of everybody pile in and let's all bring our best work, you know, to the proceedings. So by the time we got it in Weta, our effects team, that sequence, you know, effects wise was led by Claude Schitter. I think Jordan Cario was our fire lead on that one. They were working this through. We'd been making improvements since Avatar Way of Water with Loki, our fluid simulation for doing, you know, the combustion side of it. We just worked it until the detail was where it needed to be. I mean, like it's always tricky business trying to get fire to look photographic when you're dealing with the rendering aspect of it, and also just maintaining the detail there. But we just broke that up into, I can't remember how many individual sims, because five shots. It essentially worked on it as like five sub shots, but in terms of the simulation, there are so many little individual fire simulations that run up those towers just to make sure that we had all the
detail. It's hard to describe here, but like when you watch that shot, everything moving in it is added. Basically what we shot was a blank plate, you know, that had some lights in the frame at times, and they have to go and put in a burning building that gets yanked down. Anything that is moving basically is you guys, including all the horses, all the dust, all the embers in the air, all of it, basically. We just had a simple little move is all we got.
My favorite part of that fire thing, though, was there's a moment where, you know, early-ish in that shot where a marauder runs by on a horse and, like, pulls down this burning shack that's in the background. The shack goes down, and the fire simulation that came out of that one day had this beautiful vortex, sort of just the physics doing what they were going to do in the engine. And I got this, it was presented in dailies as like, yeah, the fire's doing something kind of weird out there. I was like, no, that's absolutely perfect. Don't change a thing. You've got magic. Just bottle it. Let's go. Let's make this happen. Right. But it really came to life with all the embers flying through the air there, especially when that nest comes down. There was a pass they took to add additional run of embers and smoke there that when that thing smashes into the ground, that like you could almost smell it when it engulfs the camera. And really proud of the work that was done.
It's also worth talking about, though, is all that stuff before that, Mike. All the stuff before that big Warner shot with the village of burning, when he meets all those marauders out in the wild, out there in the dark, basically. Most of that is full CG. Most of that, the environment wasn't there. We basically added that in. We shot that kind of as a reshoot, essentially, in mocap. Right during the strikes, because we couldn't get the actors and stuff, so we had to wait. And we shot a few plates here and there from that old version of the sequence, but most of that stuff, you know, got replaced. But all the stuff with Noah in the car, like all that, it's wild. If you look at it, like I can't tell. It's like a really impressive stuff.
So just technically, before we get to the performance, technically, if you're shooting a lot of these plates on location like this, especially with flame bars and stuff, there isn't any reasonable sense that you can get an HDR or get somebody to stick out probes and like get this. You're having to, I mean, obviously sometimes you go full CG, but when you're augmenting, there's just a real skill in the lighting and the compositing to make those shots sell, because there's no way possibly to technically just freeze the flames at one moment and get in there and do 360 images. It's got to be artistry.
Yeah, that's correct. I think we definitely did walk away from that shoot with some IBLs, in the sense of Sean Conway, our gaffer, and his team. You know, they did. It wasn't all flame. There was also big movie lights erected around the place with big Vortex high power LED lamps that they had this pattern flickering on. That for HDR, when we came time to take that stuff, I'd be like, all right, let's pause all the lights. Just give us a constant illumination. So at least we had a representation of the light that we could see on the set. Obviously that was that didn't include anything that we were adding ourselves, but the lights that we were, the fires that we were adding to the scene then also become a volumetric light source for us, in addition to what's there. But a lot of this just comes down to just artful lighting of the characters. I mean, there's the what it was on the day, and that's your starting point, but then you need to look at it and go, well, that's great, but it's lighting his face in a slightly weirdly flat way, or the rim's not strong enough or whatever. So let's get in there and sculpt this and beauty light it so that it looks cool. Cause I guess that's the biggest thing for me with this is like, we just hoover up every bit of data that we can from a shoot. And we've spoken before about the IBL process that we have, and it's this very automated thing, so that when it comes back, there's very little artist interaction with putting those together. But ultimately the goal is to get us to like the ground truth from the set in as few clicks as possible, because that's our starting point. That's not the finished lighting. That's just where we're beginning. And so get to that point that we can technically validate the light. Does it match what was there on the day? Great. But unfortunately, you know, the DP wasn't necessarily lighting for the character that wasn't there on the day. You know, our actor might have fair skin. The character they're playing is a really dark-skinned ape. You can't just say this was the light, therefore that, well, that's what it is. Sorry, Wes. You know, we get in there and have these conversations about, well, how can we make him like change the lighting to make him read better? You know, the difference between lighting a fair-skinned actor and a dark-skinned actor, like you would approach those two challenges differently. And so we had the same thing with our apes, with Proximus, with Silva. It's always a bit of a learning curve for everybody on the lighting side of things to sort of figure out what works for this character, what works better for that character. And all that comes into play with this stuff.
I always thought it was an opportunity. You know what I mean? The fact that we were doing this process, we could do things that most movies could not, you know, so we could do that one, or we could not waste, you know, weeks and weeks on that sequence and just do it in two nights or 15 minutes. Because so much was being done in post. So it's like, it's one of those cases where you got to use the tool for its advantages. You know what I mean?
So talk to me about directing the performances, because you obviously don't have the advantage when you're doing it like this of having the actor in the middle of the fireball. So you're directing the actor and getting their performance to fit in with a set that they're clearly not on at that instant that they're happening. How do you go about directing that? And what sort of, how do you work with the actors to get the performances you want?
Well, in that case, for the most part, we were there on set. So we actually did, before that 15-minute window where the clean plate was really counted, we actually did the same thing running through, and the behind the scenes is going to look ridiculous because we had Owen really walking through and getting his performance. And those takes, even though they were kind of first pass camera takes for the camera to learn, they were final takes for our performance. You know what I mean? So we had all that stuff. And then we have these, you know, so his eyelines are right. We have these guys, stunt guys running by with horses on their heads, horse heads on their heads. Basically, it looks ridiculous. It's crazy. It's a surreal thing. But so we had these extras running through just to give us a sense of timing for everybody. And the challenge there was like, but what Eric was talking about was, how do you get the cameraman to kind of, okay, 5 seconds here, 3 seconds there, 2 seconds, get the rhythm down, get that musical kind of nature of it down. And then, you know, the performance is just like any other movie for the most part, you know, like you just shoot the movie like you normally do. It's just, we have to shoot the movie twice, once with the actors and then once with the clean plate, where it kind of counts for the most part.
Did you lean into previs?
Some of it, you know, we didn't do a lot of previs, I guess. A lot of my previs got, as usual, gets thrown out the window at the end of the day. The egg climb, the opening egg climb stuff was fairly well previs by Halon and including some of Eric's wet aside previs. And did some storyboards too. Those usually for me right now are helping me more because they're more vague. And, you know, I don't know. I like the process of going out on set and just, oh, this would be cool. You know, just like you kind of spontaneously find it. You get inspired by the actors and the light and the pace and, you know, oh crap, we only have an hour to shoot this scene. Okay, I'm not getting 10 shots, you know, let's do it in one, you know, whatever it is. Like there's a lot of that stuff that happens in movie making, which I don't know, I always find those are like those little amazing kind of like happy accidents that just happen. These little moments of magic that you try to capture, try to bottle up. And the trick was, how do we do that in this movie that requires so much planning, so much kind of, you know, specificity and you know, rigor, you know what I mean? But I think we found it. You know, we had some really dynamic kind of camera movements, which are obviously very difficult. I think the technology on my end, I just kind of trusted Eric. They had done these movies before. You know, I knew enough to be dangerous, I like to say. So I just kind of trusted that it was going to work. If I felt like I felt it through the frame and that Owen there or any of our actors were giving it and it felt like they were committed, you know, to what they're doing through that lens, I trusted that it was all going to be fine on the other end. And it was, you know.
I mean, the thing I will say to the previs side of it is I came into this project assuming that we were going to be prevising all sorts of stuff in the film just because of your background, Wes, and 3D animation and everything else. And I was kind of taken aback when I realized how little previs we were doing in the movie and how much of it was leaning on storyboards and just the overall vibe of the scene, the shape of the scene, but not the specifics. Because, I mean, I've seen it before, you know, previous movies where the whole movie gets previs to death and everybody just gets locked onto, oh, that, yeah, but that's the shot. That's numbers. The shot. Yeah. And it sort of robs you of a bit of, I don't know, spontaneity on the day and just being able to react. So...
Yeah, I mean, certain shots, that's what I like to do. I like to previs shots. If they're really specific shots, you know, we'll previs those, but trying to get bogged down in the whole scene thing, unless it's, you know, some special reason, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I talk about facial animation now? Because one of the things that felt like a little bit, and not even a criticism, just an observation on previous, the previous trilogy, was we started to get Caesar looking a bit like, had the facial characteristics of the underlying actor that had gave him the performance, in that it sort of felt a bit like I could see him coming through in the character. Now, leaving aside, obviously, the characters in this film or any of them that are things like orangutans, which are quite not quite so similar in skull shape. When it gets to, the chimpanzee type faces, can you just talk maybe to this point that you want to have a performance that conveys to a certain extent the humanity of the underlying actor, but by the same token you don't want to start morphing the face of the ape into that of a hybrid human chimpanzee to get that performance? Like, just walk me through like how you felt about those faces.
It is funny because we spent a lot of time looking at, you know, myself, I looked at a lot of the previous movies, you know. And Caesar basically does not look like a real ape. You know, he is probably the most stylistically kind of away because you need to relate to him so much. I know a big part of that, Eric, talk about like the eyes themselves are so much a key part of that difference that makes us kind of engage with it. Whereas, you know, Proximus, for instance, has pretty much like regular chimp eyes, which is interesting. But the big thing for us was always making sure that I felt Owen in Noah. And that comes down to like facial things. And, you know, we start with a pretty base kind of chimp model, essentially. I assume it was based off Caesar, but then to find all those sculptors, it was amazing work to like find kind of the likeness of the actor in there so that you can kind of engage on a human level. If it's just a creature, it's like what I was really worried about going into this was like, I didn't want to do, you know, dogs, talking dogs and clothing. You know what I mean? It can quickly cross into this zone where you don't really buy it. You know what I mean? So that's always been, I think, a challenge, but I don't know. Like, again, I trusted the gang who've done this before.
It's an interesting point to Caesar in terms of the design of his character. I mean, I think we've come into this process and we've noticed it early on with this too, is the characters that we've done in these films that were like cast. Like we found an example, we found a piece of reference image or whatever of like, oh, look at that face. That's an amazing face.
Noah's father is a good example. Cora.
Yeah. And mother, Dora. Like both of them were just straight up like, I love the look of that chimp. Let's just make that Dora. Let's make that Cora. You know, those characters, they have such a amazing look to them. You immediately just buy into them as
very being distinct. Ape.
You know, but they're, you know, those characters also are not, they don't have a lot of screen time in the film. Whereas with with Noah, you know, the guy's in like 1,000 shots in the movie, at least.
Out of like 1,500 total. Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's definitely a sense of, we want to make sure that we can see that actor coming through, not as a humanzee that we've like done some sort of weird, you know, morphology of the two of them, but there are aspects of Noah's face. The asymmetry, for example, like his left eye is slightly lower than his right eye, you know, like, and some of those things where you just, as soon as we made that slight little shift, you go, oh, there he is. The way in particular, like Owen has this, his character is apprehensive a lot in the film. He's unsure of himself, and Owen would make this expression where he just, you know, he just sort of press his lips together, yeah. And just his face, it produced this very specific, particular, I don't know, like look to his mouth that really conveyed something beautiful. So that was one thing we latched onto early on, going, we need to make sure that Noah's facial shapes convey that, because we see him doing it all the time. And you put in enough of those little ticks, the specific way his brows, you know, again, having to sort of move away from the very rigid, you know, shelf of the chimps have. As soon as we give him the ability to like move those brows a little bit more in just a particular way, you really feel him coming through that character. And it was funny, I was chatting to Owen's parents after the premiere, and they just, that was a compliment. They just like, we could see him in so many shots. It was like, hey,
yeah,
his parents recognize him.
That,
yeah.
That top and bottom version, you're really going to see, oh, wow, it really is him. It's just, he's got his ape makeup on, you know, it's really wild. But I mean, my thing is like early on when we first started this process, you know, it was after we wrapped and we really started getting into the really nitty gritty of the design stuff. I mean, we'd spend a lot of time just making subtle moves. Like I was really obsessed with the profiles of apes, especially Suna and Noah, and just that muzzle shape and making something that felt like an ape but still was like very pleasing. So there's a lot of me liquefying and sending back to Eric, and they're like, no, that's not right, but you know, something like this maybe, you know. It's just that back and forth trying to like just find something that you're okay with looking at for freaking, you know, two hours, yeah, and 15 minutes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As much as I love Noah, I just, you mentioned just briefly the character's mother, Dar, and I've got to say, yeah, that was like a mic drop moment for me. There's a shot of her when they get to the encampment where the dam is, and there's a shot where he sees her again, and I literally turned to my wife and said, oh my God, that's brilliant CG. Like, she is so identifiable as the mother. She doesn't look like
her. She
didn't
have her costume anymore, and you still recognize her. Yeah,
you totally recognize her. She's not a major character in that sense, like, but in the, whoever crafted that, Eric, like, I mean, oh my God, mic drop, because that was just gorgeous.
So many examples of just beautiful work from the team everywhere. But again, like, you know, we had great reference of that particular chimp, and it was just like, let's bring that chimp to life. And then what Sarah Wiseman, who plays that character, the voice that she found to give to that character, you just instantly, like, there's that scene early on in the film when, you know, she's like, oh, I'm your mother. Like, the way she says that, like, it just establishes a relationship between these two characters within seconds, and you're invested in them. It's really cool.
Whereas, had they actors seen their characters before they did their performances? Right.
No. I mean, we did have two little maquettes, right? So we had one for Raka and one for Noah. They weren't exactly the finals. It was somewhere we had done some design time, and then we sent it over to Weta Workshop to kind of give us some casts, kind of, you know, reference silicone, kind of models. Yeah. They did a great job and they look incredible, but they weren't quite the characters that we ended up with. But so they had a sense of it, you know what I mean? But ultimately, yeah, they just kind of threw all that out and just focused on, you know, being there in that moment, being honest. So the real design part of it was after we got done shooting.
I think how we would have done that, even if we had, you know, the characters designed before we came into the process, there probably would have still been work done in post reacting to what we saw them doing when they were playing it. And to some degree, I mean, I do want to, you know, should there be a next one, I would love to get a jump on that earlier than we did this time around, so that by the time we do get to the shoot, there's at least a bare bones version of the, of each of those characters, so that they can inhabit those characters more easily at the start of the shoot. Because I think everybody took a leap of faith to find their character. Yeah,
there is an approach that some filmmakers have done where they've done what we nicknamed the monster mirror, right? Where you actually have a real time. So an actor can effectively see themselves and try different expressions to see how they play, and also try how subtle they can be with their sort of communicating of subtext and still carry through. Do you think that's a worthwhile thing to explore? Or do you feel like that would cause the actors to sort of limit their performances?
I personally, for me, I wouldn't let them in a weird way, because I think they're going to get in their head. They're going to see that it's not actually right, because it actually takes weeks to get it right. And so they're not going to see something that's real. So they're going to make false, misinterpretations about the process when they should just focus on behavioral things, study chimps, all the things that behavioral things that they would kind of interpret as a human, and just trust the process. So usually what we kept saying, just trust it. It's going to be fine. You know what I mean? Just do your thing. You've trained now for weeks and weeks to how to be an ape. Just do that. And there's this one great little shot in the very beginning where it's the three friends on a rock and it's sunset and it's beautifully lit and all this great stuff. And I think it's the very last shot on Owen or on Noah. In the background is Anaya, is one of his buddies, who's a great, great character too in his own right. But he has this little behavioral thing in the background. He's eating, and you just see the way he's moving his head. And we're just looking at just that for so long, because it's so animal-like. But also they're talking. It's like, it was just, this is what the actors did. They inhabited these characters, and they worked their asses off to internalize what it means to be ape. And you just see these things, like no human would sit there and do that thing that they're doing, but he's just in the background eating a little banana and acting like a monkey, an ape, and it was just, there's examples like that throughout the entire movie. And I think that's the right process, but to like, let them look at themselves and, it's like letting an actor going back to watch their takes in the tent. Sometimes people do that. You can also sometimes unspool things, and you try to find out who's capable of doing that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So Charlie Kim, who is our facial modeler who did Raka, just did an amazing job of just finding all those facial shapes to convey that through. In his spare time, he had essentially worked up something on his own where he was using like an AR kit of the iPhone and doing real-time facial capture and having it drive in Unreal a chimp face, from a tech standpoint, like really cool, really impressive. And I was joking, like, we should hire that guy. I agree with Wes. I think if the actors were getting that real-time feedback, I feel like we'd start getting too much of an ape impersonation instead of just them playing the emotion of the moment.
You want an actor looking at themselves in the mirror while they're acting in a normal thing. It's just, you just let them be in present and in there and move on. You know what I mean? Take the technical stuff out of the way, essentially.
One of the things about Raka, and for that matter, the flashback to Maurice, that for that particular orangutan, I am stunned at how much subtlety of subtext you can get into the non-verbal parts of their performance, because they don't look that human in that sense. Their faces are quite different. Their eyes in particular, I was wondering if you could talk to this, Eric, their eyes aren't giving us what we normally would get. And yet I'm sensing those incredibly important acting beats that are between the lines of dialogue. Could you talk to those?
Yeah. I mean, on one hand, I remember being at the Audubon Zoo in New Orleans back on Apes 2 and just went there a number of times through that shoot. They had this fantastic, like very Maurice-like alpha orangutan with the big face flanges, who just would sit there in his enclosure and just, tear apart phone books and just sit, like I've got these photographs of him just sitting there with, the piece of cardboard over his head to shield him from the sun. And you would lock eyes with this guy, and it was like this instant weird primordial just connection. And I mean, I know what you mean about like, they don't necessarily have the same full range of brow movement and everything else that we humans have, but like, you can definitely tell there's something going on behind those eyes.
Yeah.
So there's that aspect of it that we can certainly lean into. And then what Peter Macon, who plays Rocca, is giving us in this, like the subtlety of that performance that he was doing. We were leaning into that as well, but it goes back to just the designing the character. I mean, there was a single face that Wes like fell in love with in terms of like, that's my Rocca. Let's build that guy, who turns out to actually be a girl. reverse image search revealed that that was actually an orangutan who was in a zoo in Wuppertal, Germany, that just happens to be the town where the sister of Phil Leonhardt, one of our VFX supervisors on this show, lived. So Phil's brother-in-law went to the zoo and took all these photographs of this particular animal that really informed so much of the way, like where the hair is coming from, the very distinctive hairstyle he has. So all of that aspect fed into that character. But in the one thing that, you know, Charlie, like who I just mentioned, who was the facial modeler for Rocca, what he was able to sort of identify is that, you know, there's just this natural kind of jovial sort of shape to the brow of an orangutan, which we needed to sort of take some liberties with in terms of the shape of it, but also the fact of what we could animate around those brows. So that he wasn't always looking happy everywhere he went, because obviously he needs to be fierce, he needs to be fearful, and all these other, you know, emotions that Peter plays that character. So that was one of the biggest things around that, is just trying to find ways to bring some sculpting into the motion of those brows, because that communicates so much of the emotional state of the character at any time. It seems to work pretty well.
I'm also surprised, honestly, how much body language actually plays into those moments too. You know what I mean?
Really?
Like, yeah. There's several times we talked about it where, like, you know, for some reason we get a shot back and it was the early days before there was a model, or it was a temp model with the skeleton only. And I could tell which actor was which, just based on how they were holding themselves, how they were moving, how they were kind of, you know, it is a full body experience for those actors. It's not just face. They're all throughout their whole body, the way they play it. Like, there's a scene where it pops in my mind with Rocca, where he, like, part of the joke is how he turns his head and it's also the look in his eyes, but it's kind of everything in there. So yeah, I think that's a big part of it, actually, the body physical thing.
I mean, that reminds me of there were times where, for example, when Noah first comes over the crest of the hill and he sees his whole village burning.
Yeah.
I mean, we were rigged mocap wise. We were rigged for the area inside the village, but we weren't rigged for the area outside the village. And so it was essentially like reference for us on the day. We weren't really able to capture what Owen was doing as he came into the village. And, you know, our Paul Story, our animation supervisor, when we actually came time to make those shots, you know, we went onto our mocap stage and one of our local performers, you know, would perform some of that stuff to try and get in there. But like, and Wes immediately identified, like, it just doesn't feel like Owen. Doesn't have that specific cadence of the way that like Owen stumbled into the village.
He holds himself differently. It's weird. You really feel it. And so we ended up recapturing with Owen, and it worked out great.
Exactly. Yeah.
So on those sequences like we're describing, you're capturing mocap of the motion, of course, but you also got head mounted cameras for the faces. So you're doing that simultaneously, right?
Yeah.
Most of the time.
That gives us, I mean, exactly, most of the time. The main difference on this show is that since War for the Planet of the Apes, we've shifted to a stereo camera rig. Which gives us, you know, and that came from the R&D from Avatar: Way of Water and that whole process. But now we're actually getting a three-dimensional depth mesh of the face, 48 frames a second of these guys.
It's cool to clarify that, by the way. It's very cool again.
I was going to say, yeah, I've seen that. And that actually allows you to have a reconstruction of the face that you can actually turn in three dimensions, right? So, and actually the animator could see, if my face was being captured, they could just see not only the view we've all seen in making ofs where it's the sort of wide angle looks straight up the nose, but you actually have a three-dimensional kind of virtualization around the face.
Exactly.
And that's got to be really helpful.
It's hugely helpful in the sense of, I mean, the thing that's always been very challenging in general is trying to determine the projection, how far the lips were protruding out, or the mandible, you know, was it forward or backward, some of that kind of stuff. And so now that we've actually got the three-dimensional mesh that's been trained for each of the actors' faces, we really get a good sense of you know, what they were doing with their face in terms of depth, you know.
And you're also doing it on the camera, right? Little sidecar things on the cameras. You're doing anything there too, right?
Yeah, that was, I mean, that, again, another thing that came out of the Way of Water tech, and where on that show we were doing the real-time depth compositing, you probably have covered. We didn't need to do real-time depth compositing here, but we still had the ability to put two little machine vision cameras. I was calling them the sidecars because they were essentially straddling the map box, basically, of our main camera, which allowed us to, you know, because we were shooting anamorphically, we didn't have a lot of information above and below frame like we would if we were shooting spherical. So this gave us this extra window into what was in front of the camera, who was in front of the camera. And in the same way, we could use those cameras to reconstruct a three-dimensional mesh of anybody that was standing in front of it as an extra part of the process.
Feel who, how far behind are they and where in relationship to the 2D frame. I thought it was helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. And it wasn't a key part of our process on every shot, but in cases where we were doing FOCAP, which is a term we've been using since Rise, of like not using mocap volume, but we're using witness cameras to reconstruct the performance after the fact. It's two more eyes that have a front row seat to the performance that we could use in addition to our other witness cameras to sort of reconstruct the performance in post.
Whereas at the end when the water is coming into the bunker, how much of that could you actually get anything live action, and how much because
none of it? Water, it's all CG.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
CG. Which is kind of stunning to me. I mean, there's a few plates in there, of course, but most of the plates have so much work added to them. They're basically CG anyway. But it's stunning, man. To me, that stuff is hats off to you guys, you know, because, you know, I was like, hold your breath. Let's hope this works and go for
well,
it.
It was a conversation early on with Will in special effects going like, well, how much are you guys expecting we're going to be doing here? Because, you know, in particular, there's the car park at Sydney Olympic Village that we used for our kind of multi-story piece of that silo that you see. And it was immediately like, there wasn't even a conversation about it. It was just, forget it. We're not doing, I don't want you guys to try and do dump tanks in this space. Like it's going to be a full day reset if we go that route.
All fairness to them, it would have never worked. It just would not have looked good at all.
Yeah. Well, in terms of just the volume, the volume of water that would have been required, but more importantly, by that point in the story, there's no humans in the mix anymore. It's entirely apes that we're interacting with. And so because
apes with wet fur.
All of our ape characters have different silhouettes than the people playing them. There's no interaction that we could have benefited from a practical water dump or anything like that. So it was just like, we're going to shoot these plates dry and also just acknowledge that we're, like Wes said, we've only got a couple of actual plates in that sequence. Everything else was a full CG construction because the location didn't exist. And trying to build a set that large would have been, you know, ridiculously cost prohibitive. So
yeah. So it's one of those perfect cases where I think we're using the tool to get more money onto the screen. If we had spent all that time building those gigantic freaking sets and spending months trying to shoot something like that, we would ended up replacing it all anyway. So it's like, I think it's a perfect case where it's like, we got to, you know, we're fairly cheap. We made this movie cheaper than the last movies by like $30 million, you know? So we did this in a very responsible way. And I think that's where the VFX kind of can help you. You know, if we can use it responsibly, we can actually help alleviate some of the cost issues with movies, you know? Again, it only kind of works in our case. That's, you know, because we're CG apes and all these things, we've got a system that's built to do this thing, this machine. But, you know, we tried to use it as much as possible where it felt right.
I would be remiss if I didn't just touch on the eagles, because certainly when I first heard about the film, I didn't anticipate a lot of bird work. obviously, apes are something that Weta's done a couple of times before. Were there any challenges with the eagles that were unexpected for you, Eric, or was it?
No. All of the challenges were expected in the sense of, I mean, we've had a feather tool set plumage that goes back, I can't remember how many years now, that we've been using to do birds wherever they've come up, whether it be the Hobbit movies or whatever. But it's always, I mean, working with feathers is always a nightmarish experience in the sense of each feather is not just a piece of geometry. Each feather is literally, you know, a raucous, a central vein with just a zillion hairs on it. And so you're dealing with fur upon fur upon fur simulation to avoid intersections and all that kind of thing. So it becomes this very unwieldy for the modelers who are actually setting up the groom on the character to work with. And so we started production on this film, or post-production on this film, off of the back of the Peacemaker series that we had done Eagle-E for, obviously. So there was at least a depth of experience within the company that we knew, okay, we've got we have a hero character that needs to be feathered, and we've got at least a starting point. But we knew there were internally, there's a lot of pain around dealing with those kind of characters. And there was a new feather tool set in the works, but it wasn't quite ready by the time we needed to start building. And so we essentially had used Eagle-E as a jumping off point, but obviously had to make changes. That was Bald Eagle. These were Golden Eagles. But it had all the same pain points that we were expecting it to have. The nice thing is, by the time we got towards the end of our production, Apteryx, this new feather tool set, had become feature rich enough for the modelers to go in and sort of rework some areas of the groom that weren't quite, you know, the eagle, our hero eagle, had a bit of like almost like a feather skirt instead of, you know, smoothly conforming, you know, tightly sort of sculpted feathers around the legs and the lower body, even the feathers over the head.
That was so last, I think, right at the last minute too.
It was early,
and then right about to deliver, boom, new shots showed up.
I would say like those shots were already final. Like they'd already been approved, but we had we have the time. Let's go back and plus these shots. And so a couple of the hero close-ups of Eagle Sun benefited from a rework, both from the sculpting side of things and also the shading side of things. Emiliano Padovani, our look dev supervisor on the show, had gone back and had reworked the actual shading characteristics of the feathers. And you put those two things together and it went from being a cool looking CG eagle to like, holy shit, that's a bird.
Real.
Right. And like there are moments there between that and the way that Paul and his team actually animated the eagle. Like it wasn't acting, you know, it was
a real bird.
We wanted a very naturalistic behavior for the eagles. And so you combine all these things together and it's magic. And
there's several, from my point of view, right, on the directing side, is not doing this crazy work. It's a really interesting learning experience making this movie. Because like I constantly had like this layer of like perception kind of pulled across my eyes several times, like where I remember there's one shot of Owen when he first woke up from this like a dream that got cut of the movie, which maybe we'll get it in there, but he wakes up into his close-up, and I remember it's one of our first shots we worked on, and we got the shot and I was like, wow, that's incredible, you know, like final, done. And then like 2 weeks later, a new shot comes in and I'm like, whoa, what the? It's like it just jumped up a level and like I couldn't see it. I couldn't understand it. There was another level to reach. You know what I mean? And the same thing with that bird. Like I thought it was fine. And then, but they got so much experience. They know kind of what's not quite working. And then you turn on a new layer and it's like, oh, and now I feel like I can't go back and look at those old shots, you know, and see in the same way. So there's this great learning experience, this deep learning curve of like, you know, what's possible and sort of what to look for and like, you know, what makes something look real and not real. It's been a really great journey for me personally.
I mean, having said that though, that shot where he wakes up from the dream is still one of the high water, to me at least, is still one of the shots that I look at in the movie and I just go like, that worked out so well. I mean, to the point where that shot became final, I mean, we had a moment in Asset Dailies where I just said like, gang, let's just stop for a second. Stand back and take a look at what we're doing here. This is, right. You know, this is some pretty next level stuff. It looks so good, and it just conveys. When you see the before and after version of that shot, like there's Noah. Like he is doing what Noah or Owen did. You know, like it's really wild.
You're very technically savvy and fluent in stuff. Did you get involved in any virtual cinematography yourself? Because I know that like you're not afraid to get your hands dirty.
Yeah, honestly, we didn't really do too much of that. In a few little spots, we had a virtual camera up, but we weren't really saying, oh, this is the final camera. This is more like a reference thing for like one little sequence for that. Sequence I was talking about before, actually, in the airport, which is all full CG, and the sequence where Noah runs into all the marauders at night. We had, you know, some pretty crude, you know, Jula and myself, like kind of out on stage while we're recording or mocapping that stuff. So here's some ideas for cameras, you know, that kind of thing. If nothing else, it gives you kind of a sense for the actors to know where the camera is. That's what I find more than anything on those virtual kind of things. The actors, the really good actors, they dance with the camera. You know, they play together. It's not just like a, you know, so like, especially I remember learning this with Dylan on Maze Runner movies. You know, he kind of comes from his father was a cameraman. So he understands that relationship of an actor to a camera. So when that camera comes in close, he knows when to time it to look into the lens right here or whatever it is. Like great actors know how to kind of play with the camera. And so I find just it's helpful just on their side to let them feel someone's there with them, even just this little box, you know, with a little handheld thing to kind of feel what the camera's doing, you know, just to kind of, it helps the performance, I find, you know what I mean?
If I can steer away from visual effects for just 1 second, I'm just dying to ask you a question at a directorial level, or almost at a writing level, which is this. This film is really interesting for me in where my loyalties lie, because as a person, in some respects, I don't want the humans to win. And in another sense, I don't want them to lose. In another sense, I feel bad that the humans destroyed everything. In another sense, I want the apes to win, but then I don't want that at the expense of, you know, the mission to find the satellite codes to fail. Like, is it at all just the tone of like where the audience's allegiance is at, which is of course reflected in the subtext of the performances and the framing and everything else.
Yeah.
But were you always just able to walk that line in your head clearly, or did you feel yourself going, yeah,
that to me, that was kind of the point in a way, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing.
Is that we're, you know, we feel like we relate to Noah, this other creature, and it's the humans that are the aliens in some way. And it's about how these two creatures, well, I always thought, you know, stylistically from a design standpoint, a narrative, like that we were going to start in the ape world and you're going to think that it's an ape story. It's a story about an ape named Noah. And it's going to be this coming of age adventure that he goes on into this other world. But then we do this little sleight of hand thing. And by the end of the movie, you realize, oh no, it's actually a dual hander. It's actually an ape story and a human story. And then that's going to hopefully, you know, because this was, you know, the studio wants more of these. But you know, exactly. Hopefully people want more of them, but like, we're going to do something that's really ballsy. We're going to make basically a fourth one, which usually never works. We're going to throw out the characters that people loved in the previous ones, you know, for the most part, although Caesar is obviously a major character in this movie. And then we're going to introduce people to all new characters. And it's like, we're going to start over basically. Is that going to work? And so we just tried to take our time with that thing of that question, you know, of, are we really so different? Can we live together? Can we coexist? Can we learn to speak with each other? And that's obviously, you know, it's talking about issues in our own world today. But yeah, to me, it was never a question. I felt like, you know, we'd seen like Avatar and those other movies where you could totally relate and root for these others. You know, that's kind of the exercise here on a human level in these stories. So yeah, we just kind of went with it. You know, I was never too worried about it, I guess. But, you know, I totally understand though, when I was on the publicity circuit, especially for say foreign audiences, I got a lot of that question, like almost like it was a bad thing. I found myself rooting for the ape. Was it? And I was like, that's okay. That's not totally fine. That's actually the point here, you know. But
it'd be kind of miserable if you weren't behind Noah.
but there is something interesting about us as human beings. We're not. It's a little of a foreign idea to us, but isn't that interesting that we can have that conversation in our heads of like, why am I feeling something for someone who's not me? You know what I mean? That's kind of the point here. You know, we see ourselves in them reflected back at us and realize how we're not so different.
Okay. And just as an aside, at a personal level, if you make another one, please bring back Rucker, like make it, you've got washed away. Okay. Cause you know, I'm not talking to you if you don't.
Trust me, that conversation has been happening for a long time.
I imagine. Eric, one other technical thing I wanted to touch on. One of the things that was really interesting at Weta's work is the spectral rendering and the way that you spectrally validated all the lenses, everything basically to get a pipeline that would allow you, certainly on, I think it was like the second Apes film, to get the kind of, I'm always going to say visual fidelity, or it's almost like a color space fidelity for things like fur in dark spaces and stuff. Is that still your pipeline? Are you still doing that kind of end-to-end spectral monitoring and mapping?
Yeah, I mean, Manuka came into the mix partway through the second film, and so there are there are a couple of scenes in Dawn that used it, but then obviously the entirety of War was using that, and then by the time we got into that, we also had Fizzlight as the workflow, the framework that feeds that whole thing. But that coming into that, we've been profiling we know what the spectral sensitivity of the camera is. Can measure or use synthetic, you know, spectral emission characteristics of our light sources. We're upsampling performing spectral recovery, let's say, on our HDR maps for IBL. And all of our texture maps are getting spectral recovery performed on them as well. And so the light transport within Manuka is entirely happening in the spectral domain. But the thing that we've never accounted for is what's between the sensor and the scene, which is the lens. And it's kind of just always been assumed that, we know what the T-stop was, so therefore this much light's coming through. Fair. But what's happening in between all those layers of glass in terms of the transmission of it all? And so it's a problem I'd been thinking about for a number of years, and it just kind of tinkering on the side. Eventually, by the time we got around to shooting this, had built a little portable rig, essentially using kind of some optomechanical stuff and some camera parts, and took that to Sydney with me and spent the glorious afternoon at Panavision measuring the actual transmission of every one of our Panavision anamorphic lenses that we're using. Because some of these, you know, the lens package we had was a mixture of these vintage 60s and 70s lenses and the T series, which I think were like 2015, similar character, but newer construction, newer methods.
The idea there was, as the story kind of progressed more into modern humanity, that the lenses became clearer in a way. So Noah's world, the beginning of the movie was all C series, very crude and rough looking. Yeah. As kind of the world came into focus, like the images themselves actually get a little crisper, which I actually kind of prefer a little bit personally. But
yeah, but the main thing was just figuring out what each of those lenses were doing. And so
you're allowing for the coatings now, the actual glass coatings is basically what you're modeling.
It's essentially shining, you know, a collimated light through the lens and measuring it with a spectrometer on the other side and figuring out exactly what is being transmitted through each of the lenses. So we had essentially we're storing that per lens, and the metadata of every shot contained what lens was used to shoot that lens. So we just built it into the validation system at Weta, where this shot was using the C-series 50 mil. Okay, therefore the lens is tinted slightly yellow-green by exactly this much. And so it the same thing, we measured the transmission of our fisheye lenses that we used to capture the HDRI. And so you take the HDRI, you back out the contribution the fisheye was doing, and then you can, you know, bake in the contribution that the shot lens was doing, and you get just that much closer to ground truth without any fiddling. You know, obviously it's funny, the thing I equate it to almost is like hi-fi audio. It's like you spend this much time and this much money to get that much better performance out of it. You know, it's like as soon as you start getting closer and closer to the truth.
But guys, I've got to say, like, this is what I love about this film so much, right? Is that, like, you get it technically right so that I'm desperate to see one of the characters come back in the next film because I care about the character so much. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to care about the character so much if I don't
connect
with them.
Hopefully people watch this and they're not thinking of all this pretty technical stuff, you know, on this whole movie. And that's what's wild to me is my learning experience on this side of things, doing something that's, I mean, obviously I've worked with Weta now for 2.5 movies, essentially, now 3. And doing something that was so heavy, like, just talking about all that stuff, Eric, like, I don't think I ever saw a first shot version that I felt like didn't feel real. You know what I mean? I'm sure there were many versions before I saw them, Eric, but, like, for the most part, there's a few shots, but, like, I don't think this doesn't feel real. But for the most part, the comping and all that kind of stuff, the lighting and all that kind of stuff, it felt real. So all we were talking about was those little details about that little eye thing or that little feeling that I'm not getting or whatever it was. Like, we're already so far down the field that we get to spend most of our time on the stuff that really, really, really matters. You know what I mean? Not that the other stuff doesn't, but I don't know if that played into it, this new kind of approach to your spectral stuff. But I was shocked by that because I thought it was going to take a lot of, you know, effort and time to, like, you know, we have to relight this or all that kind of stuff. But, you know, for the most part, from my standpoint, we didn't. We just got to focus on the important stuff, you know?
If you can get the shot to actually work, then you can start worrying about what you want the shot to say rather than just trying to get it up. Yeah.
Well, there's sometimes we actually plus the shot up where it's like, we didn't plan on this, but what if we did this shadow on the background? Yeah. Or what if we did this light rim on the back or put wind in the fur? Or my big thing was, I wanted bugs everywhere. I wanted bugs in all the shots. So they figured out how to do all that stuff. So I got to really play in that on that side of stuff that I thought was really fun.
Yeah, the improvements on the technology, this measuring the lenses thing, obviously it's not making a night and day difference to the shot, but if it gets us that much closer to, you know, the truth, if it gets that much closer to where it's supposed to look like, then we can spend our time talking about the creative side of it instead of the technical side of it. You know, that's where we want to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true of any pursuit, right? Like that last 10% is the one that like takes all the effort, but it's also the one that makes the difference. Yeah, exactly. Guys, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. Wes, thank you so much for shooting Sydney to make it look so nice in the background.
Yeah,
it looked good on the screen here and when I was watching it. And and congratulations. As I say, I applaud everything about this film, and thank you so much for taking time to talk to us.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
Always a pleasure, Mike.
A big thanks to both Wes and Eric for taking the time to talk to Mike for the podcast. And once again, head on over to FXPhD to check out Wes's course from back in the day. That's it for this FX podcast. For Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.